This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I want you to try something very easy. Lift up your right leg and then wiggle the toes on your left foot. Pretty easy, right? But do you know why you can do that? How do these instructions from your head through your spine to your foot result in that little wiggle of your toe? One of my next guests says that one of the big questions today is exactly, how do the brain and spinal cord communicate? Who's the boss, so to speak, when it comes to movement? And what happens when something goes wrong? She and her colleagues have taken one step towards answering that question, because by implanting an electrical device in the spines of four paralyzed men, they were able to help those men stand and move their legs again. Not quite walking yet, but a milestone along the way. The results appear in the journal Brain. How did they do it? How can you retrain a damaged spinal cord to make voluntary movements again? How soon might we see a device like this on the market? Susan Harkema is an author on that study. She's a research director at the Fraser Rehab Institute and the Kentucky Spinal Cord Injury Research Center at the University of Louisville. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Harkema.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Roderick Pettigrew, director of the National Institute of Bioimaging and Bioengineering in Bethesda, Maryland, which helped fund the study. Welcome, Dr. Pettigrew.
Thank you, Ira. Delighted to be here.
You're welcome. Dr. Harkema, tell us what you did here. You implanted a small device in the spines of four men with paralyzed legs.
Yes, we did. We implanted them in the lower spinal cord, and we really originally did it for a different series of experiments. And our first observation of this voluntary movement was really brought forward by our first research participant. Rob Summers was bored in an experiment one day and said, "Let me see if I can move." It was not part of our original hypothesis, because we did at that time believe that was not possible, because voluntary movements are controlled by the brain and the spinal cord would need to be provided with complex signals in order to do that. So that was very surprising to us. But he did have some sensation. So we knew that there were still some sensory fibers connected from the spinal cord to the brain. And we thought, because it happened 7 months after intense locomotor training combined with epidural stimulation, it may have driven plasticity in the brain and spinal cord to really make these motor pathways instead of sensory pathways. So we tested that hypothesis by implanting a second person who was complete both from a motor standpoint and a sensory standpoint. So at that time, we couldn't detect any connections from the brain. And when he was implanted, we told him that we did not think, we thought it would be very highly unlikely that he would move again, that this was really an experiment to test that hypothesis. And we were very astonished to see that on the first try using epidural stimulation, he was able to make a movement.
Wow. Do you have any idea of how this works?
Well, I mean, you know, this opens up a whole realm of possibilities and new experiments, but our working theory really is as follows. I mean, we had always believed that, as I said, that the brain, we always thought that the human movement was controlled by the brain, and the spinal cord was simply a conduit for those brain commands. But the results of these experiments suggest to us that the human spinal cord has a tremendous capacity for recovery, even without reconnecting to the brain, that the spinal cord itself integrates complex signals from the environment and signals from the brain to then decide itself what movement will happen and then execute that movement. So that's our working hypothesis now.
So when your subjects thought about moving their limbs, it did not have to come from the brain?
Well, we still believe it comes from the brain, but I don't think we can suggest, I mean, I think in these individuals, that signal has to be very weak,
right?
Very, very weak. It can't be complex.
Right.
So what we think that the stimulation puts the spinal cord in the best state for it to be able to execute the desired movement, so that when a weak signal from the brain can so that the weak signal from the brain can be interpreted by the networks, the complex networks in the spinal cord, and then the movement can be executed. Hmm. So really, the details of movement, the details of the control of movement are really at the level of the spinal cord.
Dr. Pettigrew, this is not like the experiment we do as kids in eighth grade with frog legs. You know, just taking a battery and they twitch. It's different than that, correct?
You're quite right, Ira. One of the interesting things about this study is that it seems to support the theory that Dr. Harkema was explaining, which is that one of the things that happens in the spinal cord injury process is that not only are nerve tracts interrupted, but it appears as though the neurons involved in motion are damaged in such a way that they are unable to respond to signals and stimuli as they normally would. And what this type of low-level electrical stimulation that's imparted just above the spinal cord seems to accomplish is that it reprograms or resets the excitable level of these motor neurons so that once again they are responsive to signals that come in from various stimuli. As you point out, this is quite different from what we do with frogs where you actually try and stimulate the muscles directly to contract.
We usually focus on successes like moving legs again or standing or trying to walk, but there are other functions that the patients regain also. Is that right? Like sweating, for example?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, Susan knows this perhaps even better.
Okay, but I get Susan. Susan, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, sure. So we had many observations that were also unexpected. What I think people don't really understand, they think about walking with people with paralysis, but the heart doesn't function as well. The lungs, circulation is poor. It's difficult to regulate temperature. Bowel and bladder function is significantly disrupted. And what we found, not directly from the stimulation, but just overall, many of those things improved. And so that also was brand new knowledge to us. And so what this also tells us is that it is very important for the neuromuscular system to stay active after a spinal cord injury, that it may be that inactivity is really contributing to a lot of these secondary conditions. But we don't know the answers to that. We don't know why, and more experiments need to be done for us to understand those mechanisms.
Did you see results immediately when you put a voltage on there and they were able to respond immediately, or did it take some time?
So in the first individual, it took 7 months, but you have to remember we never tried it. So we really don't know if he would have been able to do it early on. The other three were able to do it right away, but with the intense training and the continuous stimulation, they continued to get better at all the movements.
Could it be that the stimulation stimulated the body to try to repair
the
nerve damage?
We don't think that's a viable hypothesis now, because in that case, you wouldn't see a response immediately.
Right.
It would take time for even plasticity to occur, which was our original hypothesis. Now, we do think plasticity is occurring over time, and that's why we're seeing continued improvements as they continue to use the device and to train intensely. We don't have any evidence that there's regeneration, that you're growing new neurons. We do not think that's what's happening.
Dr. Pettigrew, do you think we're going to need many more cases of study before we think that this is a viable treatment, or should we just start doing this right now?
Well, the nature of science is that you begin with fundamental studies to understand the mechanisms involved in dysfunction. And that leads you to fashion therapeutic procedures and approaches such as the one used by these researchers. Then you proceed from that to try and refine those approaches. This is a continuum from basic discovery to initial translation to improvement and working towards your ultimate goal, which would be to reverse paralysis completely. This has been likened to a marathon, which is more of the nature of science as opposed to a sprint. So what has been observed in this first four patients is indeed very exciting news, but it is the beginning. It is far from being at the end. We need to explore this in additional patients to understand the actual mechanisms by which this works, how to improve it, for whom it works, for whom it does not work, and apply it to a broader segment of the population.
Susan, I'm just as fascinated by not only by the results, but by what you're saying is that we need to rethink about, I'm going to put it this way, how smart the spinal cord is.
Absolutely. The spinal cord is as smart as the brain, and that's what these experiments are telling us. It can remember, forget, make decisions, create signals that control the muscles in a complex way, create commands, if you will. And I would even say teach. What may be happening as they continue to improve is that the spinal cord is teaching the brain a new way to send its signals. But that all needs to be explored. It's exciting that with this new knowledge, we've opened up a realm of possibilities for further study and also for driving recovery after paralysis.
And so how many more patients can you line up and what kind of study? Do you need a larger study nationwide?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we need to continue on with the basic science experiments in our human model so we can understand these underlying mechanisms. But we do also need to see the results in a larger population, different ages, different times since injury, different types of injuries. I mean, I think it's promising because these are the most severely injured. So, you know, it'll be very interesting to see when there's even more available input saved from the brain, what could happen.
Are you saying that there is, in some of these patients, there's a complete break?
Well, so we have to rethink that also. I mean, I don't think we ever thought there was very rarely is there complete transection, but terms are used as clinically complete or functionally complete, right, that by any means, you can't detect any connection from the brain. And so that's what the category these individuals were in. We think now that that's not the case. And I think we need to rethink how we're treating people with spinal cord injury now. If you're diagnosed with a complete injury, you really don't get rehabilitation below the lesion. You're taught how to compensate, and that might be contributing to the secondary conditions. So I think right now there are treatments like locomotor training that all people with paralysis could benefit from even years after injury.
Why not just start people on some modified or some basic form of what you're doing?
Well, there's some hurdles we have to overcome. This was an off-the-shelf device that wasn't designed for this purpose. So there has to be an advancement in the technology. That will have to go through all the regulatory and safety, you know, procedures. We also we're going to have to train physicians and physical therapists in this new knowledge base and how to implement the treatment. And then, of course, hospitals and healthcare providers will need to decide that this is a value. So there's lots of hurdles to go through that, you know, aren't directly related to the science.
Yeah. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Susan Harkema and Roderick Pettigrew. But I'm sure I don't have to tell you, and I'm sure I don't know for a fact, but I'm guessing from other programs and other stories that we've done, that you are already swamped with people who want to know how to do this.
Yes, we are.
And what do you say to them? Wait, I know you have friends, loved ones, whatever, who are in the same condition. But you just have to be a little more patient?
Yeah, it is very difficult because you can imagine, and I don't know that everyone appreciates how difficult it is to live with paralysis and how it affects the caregivers and the family members and friends to see your loved one struggle so much through life. But I hope, on the other hand, that this also is a positive thing, because in the past, really, there hasn't been anything that's been available or considered to be available short of regeneration, and we're still a ways away from that. So, yes, I mean, I think we all have to work hard. We need to bring collaborators together. We need to bring all the stakeholders together to invest in this so we can move it forward and we can make it more accessible to more people sooner in a very safe and strategic way.
Given the age we are of miniaturization of devices and microchips and things, do you see a day not too long in the future where it's not implantable? It could just sit on the skin?
There's also a line of research going on, also funded by the NIH, to see the usefulness of that. And so there's lots of areas of research that are going forward. And so for obvious reasons, that would be ideal. I think we can learn by using the implant and able to design those, because that's going to be a little more difficult to get to the spinal cord circuitry. But absolutely, I think it's in the realm of possibility.
At least, you know, if people are frustrated about not being able to get one of your devices that you've used right now, at least you've given people hope, right? Mm-hmm. That not too far down the road, there might be some treatment for somebody who's suffering.
Yeah, we'd like to think that, but I think it also, I'd like to think this gives the message that we should be activating the neuromuscular system below the lesion, and there's ways to do that out in clinics now that could benefit people now. Mm-hmm. So to keep that up, to keep, stay healthy, and we're learning new things every single day, so keep listening.
Dr. Pettigrew, you would agree. Keep the action going.
Keep the action going. And actually, I'd like to comment on a couple of things that have already been cited. The first is a discussion about improving the technology. And as Susan mentioned, the National Institutes of Health is currently funding additional studies to improve the technology that was used in this initial study. And one of the things that we look forward to is a device that will be totally non-invasive, that will not require surgical implantation of the electrodes, can be placed on the skin and achieve the epidural type of stimulation of the networks just above the spine, through electrodes placed on the skin. This will open up even to a greater extent the availability of this technique to other individuals, because it will be simpler to implement.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to leave it there.
I
have to leave it there. We're running out of time. We will revisit this issue, and it's certainly very, very interesting and hopeful news. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Roderick Pettigrew, Susan Harkema, talking about research on spinal cord injuries.